The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hi there. Welcome back once again to I Never Thought It Would Happen, brought to you by my good self, Chris Difford, and the wonderful charity Help Musicians. I'm so happy to welcome one of Britain's greatest and most commercially successful songwriters, best known for being a founder member of one of the 80s most loved bands, a band who alongside Duran Duran, Wham and Culture Club took America by storm in the mid-80s. In fact, his song True won an award for achieving an amazing 4 million plays on US radio. And I can tell you that takes some doing. He's also done some acting on TV. He's made a film or two. He has his own podcast. And currently splits his time between a solo career and playing amazing guitar work in the band Saucerful of Secrets with Nick Mason from Pink Floyd. He is, of course, the beautiful, very handsome Gary Kemp. Good morning, Gary.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Or is it good afternoon, just by a 1 minute?
Ah, yeah. Of course. So, how correct of you.
I know, how correct of me. So welcome to this Help Musicians podcast. And it's very kind of you to join us. I know you're a busy boy promoting your new album. How does that feel to be promoting a new album?
Well, it feels good. Yeah, it feels like, you know, confirmation that I'm creative. You make a record. You go through the process of making the record, which is sort of threefold. You know, you begin by writing the songs. And I don't write the songs in the studio. I write the songs in my writing room.
Right.
They're complete by the time I arrive at my studio. Not all of them, but, I don't have all 11 songs when I arrive, but I take a song into the studio when I've finished it. You then go through the process of putting the instrumentation on, choosing the arrangement. That's normally when I hit crisis point.
Right.
That's normally when I think, this is crap. What the hell am I doing? You know, I go up and down. It's like real extreme highs. This is amazing. And then to feeling awful about it. And in the end, we get there. Then it's sort of the record company and the artwork and the packaging and working out what it's called and also laying the tracks out, right? You know, just into that two-act order of a piece of vinyl, which is always in my mind, no matter what I'm making.
Yeah.
But then you suddenly find yourself on cooking programs. You know? Or cooking podcasts. Various different ways of trying to tell people you've got a record out. I did Lorraine this morning, you know.
Right.
Lorraine is amazing. I love Lorraine. She first interviewed me 41 years ago.
Christ almighty.
But, you know, so I think, and now I'm here with you. But so I think there are interesting moments in the process of making a record revealed to a public.
I know. When you look back to when you were a young lad and you were starting out in the music industry with a fistful of songs, was your ambition just to be on things like Top of the Pops rather, you know, and to be sort of prancing around on that wonderful little tiny stage of theirs?
Yeah, I don't know whether any of us thought about what we'd be doing in our retirement, which is not going to happen. I spoke to a friend today who I grew up at school with. He was in my class at school, and he's retired now. He's 2 weeks into his retirement.
Yes.
And I feel just about the opposite. I feel like I'm into another phase of work.
Yeah.
You know, I was fortunate enough to choose a job that I, you know, really enjoyed. But to answer your question, I think you only think a few yards in front of you at the beginning. You're not, you know, at that stage, 1980, I'm guessing that, you know, I'm 21, that Mick Jagger is in his late 30s.
My God.
And that's as old as it gets.
Yes, definitely. Right? Now look,
that's
at
as
it.
Old as rock and roll hadn't reached 40 yet. You know, no yeah. one was in their 40s playing rock and roll when we first made a record contract. So you never thought it or imagined that you'd be doing. I never thought about what I'd be doing. You know, people would then arrive at my house trying to sell me pensions, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought seriously about what is my pension, you know. What will I be doing when I'm 35?
Yeah.
You know, so to think that we're still here is formidable.
What moment in your career do you think you first felt a real breakthrough? And what did that feel like?
Yeah, I suppose there was a buzz about Spandau Ballet that we'd sort of generated ourselves, but through this weird group of followers who weren't following just us. I mean, we were following them, you know. It was, you know, creative people, young mixture of straight and gay and suburban and urban, and these guys were surrounding us with so much energy, and there was a real sense of this is the next big thing, and the press were already picking up on that. So the wave started to lift really early on, even before we'd signed a record contract, and then without us even doing hundreds of gigs, you know. So that was, you know, I remember appearing in the Daily Mirror. I remember Janet Street Porter saying, "We want to do a documentary about you." And what did we think? So you should be. And, you know, we had a lot of that. And I think that was a really big moment, that documentary.
Was it?
Which had a programme. Do you remember it? It was called 20th Century Box.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Yeah.
It was on Sunday lunchtimes.
Yeah.
Kind of youth telly. And I know the Pistols had been on. She'd had the Pistols on. And Danny Baker used to present it.
Good Lord.
It started off with Danny Baker sitting, like, in front of a green screen image of something. And on today's program, we are talking to a band called Spandau Ballet. And, you know, because Danny was, he was the reception boy at NME.
Yeah, he was. And, you know, he'd already been working in a record shop in Oxford Street. I mean, he was, already carved a little bit of a career for himself.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, how some kids love music business, but they don't choose to want to be in a band.
Yeah.
I didn't meet any of those guys until later, but they actually actively choose to be something, you know, like a David Hepworth or a
Gary Crowley.
Yeah. Well, Gary,
he
got the buzz really early on. Sorry, do you mind me digressing?
Oh, no,
here?
Please do. I love this.
So Gary Crowley, who's now, you know, he's got his own show on Radio London, and he's been a DJ for years, a radio personality. He did that TV program, I think, called White Light, back in the very early 80s. He presented that.
Yeah.
And anyway, before Spandau Ballet, after Steve Norman and I had seen the Sex Pistols and went back into school in the September and formed what became Spandau Ballet, but without my brother, with a different bass player. And we were kind of playing power pop, and that's who we wanted. That's how we saw ourselves, like a Generation X type band. Played gigs like at the Roxy, supporting Chelsea and Killing Joke.
Mm-hmm.
And all that happened. Gary Crowley appears at one of our gigs, and we don't know who he is. He's this kid, and he's got a fanzine. He's a kind of mod kid into the jam. And he starts becoming a really good mate. And he and Steve Dagger, our manager, used to just gas for hours on the phone. I mean, Gary, tell me, he used to just go down to the phone box with loads and loads of coins, just talking to Steve Dagger all night. And so Gary was a big supporter. Anyway, people like that, yeah, they don't think I'm ever going to be in a band.
No.
Where, for me, right from the start, it was...
ambition.
That's all I ever wanted.
That was your ambition. And did that
start? Not to be a solo artist. Not to be a solo. I don't think anyone, very few people had the balls to want to be a solo artist. I've no idea how someone like Elvis Costello, you know, chooses that he doesn't need a band.
No, that's a very good point. I think, speaking for myself, I guess when I was at school, the ambition, you know, I'd grown up in a gang. And I saw being in a band as just being an extension of being in another gang, except this gang would go around in a transit van eating fish and chips, smoking fags, drinking beer and playing gigs. And that was, and that was a wonderful ambition at the very beginning. The dynamics of a band are often very challenging. How did you cope?
At the beginning, I think you're right. It's strength in numbers.
Yeah.
It's the, you know, you can snap a stick, but not a bundle of sticks. It's wherever that one comes from. It's a working class thing, I think.
Yeah.
I think working class kids don't have the bravado. They don't have the private tuition. They don't have the confidence to go it alone. They stand firmer in a gang. And when a gang has got a uniformity about them, a look, it's more impressive. I mean, do you imagine the Beatles if one of them had ginger hair and curly hair? I mean, it wouldn't have worked, right? So there has to be a uniformity. And I do think, you know, Elvis came from a more middle class background, and that, you know, I listen, this isn't a fact. I've not done a survey on this, but I'm sort of guessing that is why we want to form bands. And the challenge of being in with different people. Yeah, because there's a lot of bullshit spoken about bands. And it normally comes from the fans who are convinced you were all mates at one time. You know, oh, when you were friends, you know, like you were great friends. Why don't you like each other anymore? But we were never friends. He just happens to be the only bloke we knew who played guitar. Or he was the only one who knew how to drum kit. Oh. You know, so you become work acquaintances, you know.
Yeah.
That's what you are. And you spend an inordinate amount of time in each other's pockets.
Yeah.
You know, at least at work, you get to go home.
Yes.
But you don't, do you?
No, I know. And it's something that is a constant battle for some people. It is for me, you know. I think it's challenging to still be in a band 50 years later, the sort of chemistry that one can have with other people. And it is like, to, you know, somebody said to me, well, it's just like working in a bank. You don't see them when you're not touring. And then the next time you see them, you're in a dressing room somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the compromise that you have to make.
Yeah.
You're, strangely enough, less willing to compromise the older you get, right?
Yeah.
You know, you have your village. Mm. That's your family.
Yeah.
And you live there. And that's takes a lot of compromise, but you've come to a loving arrangement to make that work.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are people outside of your little family village who go, right, we're going on the road and we're all going to sleep together and we're going to go away for 8 weeks. I'm really excited. And you're just like, oh fuck, I'm not excited at all, you know? I'm going to miss my kids, you know, and stuff like that, because everyone's different now. They've all got different lives. Some people have never had children, some people have had children who are grown up, some people have got little kids. You know, we're all living such different lives. When you're at the beginning, when you just left school, you're living exactly the same life.
Yes, you do. That's very true. It's very true.
24/7.
And I mean, having a family in a group, was that interesting? Because I never had a brother in a band, but it felt like it at times. You know, when you've got that family dynamic as well as being in a band, that's quite a few balls to juggle.
Well, a lot of people, you know, don't succeed with it. I mean, you know, the Davis brothers come to mind, and of course the Gallagher brothers come to mind.
Yes.
I'm sure there are other examples. For me and Martin, it was actually the opposite. It gave us a sense of home when we were away. It connected us with our parents. We're the only two siblings, so that made it easier for mum and dad, as it were.
Yeah.
Don't believe what you see in the mockumentaries. Ross isn't our brother. And then, so it's, I think it was good for us. And if we did need to let off steam, we could do that with each other, quite blisteringly at times, but within minutes we'd be bonded again. And I think that was often a bit disconcerting for the other members of the band. But the other good thing, Chris, is that when I'm not in the room and my brother is, they still can't talk about me.
That's really good.
Which I know that was a useful tool that the Krays used.
So. Yeah. That's really good, yeah. So is there a particular instrument or a piece of equipment that you purchased very early on that was very significant for you, and do you still have that guitar or that piece of gear?
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, the very first guitar I got, my dad bought from an electric shop. Do you remember that? You used to buy guitars in electric shops.
Okay.
So there'd be like a washing machine, a hairdryer, oh, and there's a guitar.
Yeah. You know?
And he'd seen it in the window of a Holloway Road electrical shop.
Oh, my God.
Actually, I'm not the only guy who has this. I think Johnny Marr talks about this as well. I think his first guitar came from an electrical shop in Manchester. And I don't know why he thought it was a good idea. I got a feeling it was a Hofner. I exchanged it for an electric one a few years later. It was a sort of arch top F-hole cheese cutter of a guitar. You know, the strings were about a mile away from the fretboard. And so that was the guitar that I discovered I was a songwriter on, because I learnt four chords and started writing songs straight away.
Yeah.
I wrote two songs almost immediately. One was called Alone, and my mum said, you can't play that to anyone, they'll think you're depressed. But what's interesting is I still know it. I still know both those songs.
Right.
They were created by an 11-year-old kid in his bedroom, and they don't die.
No.
You know, as long as I'm alive, they're still around. But to answer your question more directly, I bought two Strats in 1981 that were 1979 Stratocasters, and one was black and one was a kind of cream. And the cream one was the guitar that I recorded Gold, True, and those, you know, key songs, Lifeline. It had a kind of Nile Rodgers feel to it. And it's the guitar that I still use on stage with Sourceful of Secrets.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's 46 years old. And it's, I've changed it around a few times. I've added various different pickups and things, but and had it refinished once. But it's the guitar that I wouldn't give away. But there is another guitar, which is the one behind me here, which is the black one that I bought at the same time. And for a short time, that was actually the guitar I preferred live. So when we went out with to do the True Tour, that was a guitar that I mostly played. And then I had that on stage at Live Aid, and I played True on that guitar at Live Aid. And then in the 90s, I realised that I didn't have it anymore. It wasn't in my lockup. It had gone.
Wow.
It was a couple of guitars that were stolen, about two or three guitars that were stolen. And just in the end, it just, like, I gave it up. You know, I wasn't ever going to find it. I don't know what happened to it. And about 2 years ago, someone sent me a picture saying, is this your guitar? And it was that black one hanging in a little guitar museum at the back of a shop in Lincolnshire. And it said Spandau Original Guitar, spelt E-A-U at the end of Spandau. And we got in touch. My people got in touch, of course.
Yeah.
And said, how did you get it? And it turned out he'd bought it without any papers, so it wasn't guaranteed provenance.
Yes.
Without any papers. He bought it from an antique dealer in Twickenham, turns out, who'd got it from someone who'd come in the shop saying, I used to be a roadie with Spandau Ballet.
Oh, no.
And Gary Kemp had no money and paid me in lieu of the cash with this guitar.
Oh, no.
So,
what a story. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Anyway, I went up to Lincolnshire. I said to the guy who had it, I said, how much did you pay for it? And he told me, he said, just give me that money and I'll give that money to charity and you can have the guitar. And it was a fantastic sort of moment, really, just to connect with it. Because it's a family heirloom.
Yeah.
You know, it's the guitar I played True on stage at Live Aid with.
Oh, that's so beautiful. So great.
Have you ever spoken to Peter Frampton about his lost guitar?
No, which one was that?
Yeah, I think it was the Gibson with the three pickups, the custom. And I think he thought it had got lost in a plane crash in South America.
Yeah.
And then years and years and years later, he gets it back.
Oh, that's amazing. Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been watching you play on the Sourceful of Secrets tour, Nick Mason. Your guitar work was so impeccable. And I wonder, did you have to study for that tour, or did it just fall off the fretboard?
No, you have to study for that tour, because Floyd Universe, Floyd people are very discerning. They're a very picky audience. I mean, you know, passionate, but some of them could be fly dentists about these things, you know. They want to get in, know exactly, get the tone right. You know, Nick said right from the beginning, this is, you know, everyone has freedom in this band. This isn't a tribute band. But nevertheless, you know, you really want to get things right. You want to nail them when you need to. And, you know, building those arrangements with the other boys and Nick was, you know, carefully thought through. And yeah, you know, but I mean, I'm if I'm going out again later this year with Nick, you know, I'll spend, you know, I'll woodshed for a bit. You know, I'll sit in my little studio and go over the songs and try and work them out and get them sounding, you know, get my fingers playing them properly again. It's been a great opportunity for me, Chris, because, you know, I never got to do that in Spandau Ballet because there was always a saxophone solo waiting around the corner. And a fellow with a massive voice, you know. You know, we have very minimal arrangements in Spandau.
Yes.
It was very, the guitar fits here, the keyboard fits there.
Yes.
And that was the sound of that period, that 80s sound. So I get to sort of riff a bit more and show off a bit more, if you like. But it's nerve-wracking, I have to say. It's nerve-wracking.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Because, you know, when I saw the Pistols, I suppose what was odd about it is he wasn't actually wearing it that night. But the fact that Johnny Rotten famously had a T-shirt which said Pink Floyd on it, and he had written at the top, "I hate Pink Floyd." I mean, I think he wore it when he turned up at Malcolm McLaren's for his audition at Vivian Westwood's shop, for his audition around the jukebox, where he famously sang to 18 by Alice Cooper. And it's obviously ironic that he turned me on so much, and here now I am in the Pink Floyd universe itself.
That's amazing. I just written a song called Pink Floyd, and
oh really,
and Guy Pratt very kindly played bass on it because it's got a verse about Guy.
What's it about though?
Well, it's about how my parents hated it and thought that it was music that would convert me into being a drug addict, which it did. So they were right. But it's also a tribute in some kind of ways, because I saw them twice when I was a kid, and those both were amazing experiences.
Yeah. You know what's interesting about what I love about your lyrics is you're always specific, never general. So, you know, if you're going to say biscuit, you don't say biscuit, you say bourbon or custard cream. And when you're really specific, like if you're going to, you know, you're actually naming that band, I think it's much more interesting.
You know what, Gary, I should send you the track and you should play your guitar all over it. It'll be wonderful.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favourite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Chris Difford, and you're listening to I Never Thought It Would Happen, Coming up next, I'm answering your questions, and I can't wait to read your emails. Hi there, this is a message from Kate Collins in South Wales. I saw you this evening at the wonderful venue, The Met, where we really enjoy theatre, live music and cinema all year round. The gig was fantastic. I hope you realise that you made several of us cry. Absolutely wonderful stories and top-notch humour accompanying all of those brilliant songs of yours. Thank you so much. But I thought I'd ask about how you feel after a gig and how it differs depending on things like venue, town, crowd reaction. Do you find it easier or more difficult to wind down after a big gig? Well, Kate, I remember that show extremely well because I was very tired from two previous nights playing and a lot of travelling in between, and it's that that makes me tired and wears me out. And after that show, I was driving home and had a bit of a wobble. And since then, I've taken a break from touring to kind of get myself back on my feet. Every show is different. Every show brings joy and happiness, and I just love meeting new people and seeing new faces in the audience. So a little wobble's not going to stop me. Thanks for your message, Kate. Pete from Barnsley. Hi, Chris. It's been really fascinating listening to your various answers to listeners' questions. I have loads I could ask, but I hope this one gets through to you. It's about your Let's Be Coombe Avenue demo album. It seems a really brave thing to put out, warts and all recordings of you as much younger man, bashing through some songs. So here's my question, or two, I suppose. How did you find these old demos, and what were your feelings when you heard them for the first time? And secondly, what's the reaction been like from Squeeze fans? Thanks, from Pete. Well, Pete, on my block, on my council estate where I used to live, was a guy called Bob Blatchford, and he had a Grundig tape recorder. In those days, quite an item. Used to weigh like a ton of bricks. He recorded me one afternoon with the songs that I'd written at that point, before Squeeze, way before Squeeze. Very ambitious it was. And then I forgot all about it. One day I was doing a solo show and he turned up with a Tesco bag many, many years later and said, "These are yours." But the only problem was I couldn't find a Grundig tape recorder to play them on, so I had to find a recording studio and a very good engineer, and it was amazing to hear them. Very emotional it was. Well, what's the reaction been like from Squeeze fans? Well, it's hard to say, really. I don't really tune into what people say or on the internet particularly. But I think generally, I think it was a good move. And I hope you agree. On my next tour coming up in September and October 25, I'll be doing more of those songs. Hope to see you there, Pete. What sort of discipline do you have as a writer? Like, let's take on board something like True that you wrote many years ago. Did you have a lot of discipline around that, or did it just fall out of the sky?
Yeah, I think they did fall out of the sky. I was already with True. I was already beginning to understand structure, I think, because I was intrigued by modulation and key change. And so I wrote this key change within the song for the saxophone solo. So it lifts up the sax, goes into a completely different key. And then at the end of that solo, goes back down to the original key. So I was obviously understanding structure, you know, 22, sort of self-taught at home. But the pressure was always, I had to have a certain amount of discipline in writing because, you know, we'd finish a tour and then, you know, we were a successful band and we needed to, you know, have another hit album out pretty soon after a tour.
Yeah.
So there was no other writers in the band, so I was nervous about trying to get ready for an up-and-coming studio arrangement. You know, oh, we're going to go in the studio in Christmas, you know, and my God, I haven't written a single song. But I think the when I did True album, I found that such a breath of fresh air for me, because up until then, first two albums, they were about groove, they were about riffs, they were about kind of swagger and stance, and then it was a really, you know, it was a thrilling moment for me to think, I'm just going to write tunes. I'm just going to write good tunes, going to write good songs that work without synthesizer riffs or drums or, you know, and then that was the beginning of a kind of sound that we'd found, and me as a songwriter finding my feet amongst the major sevenths.
Yeah. Your new album, thematically, I suppose, is about home, I guess. There's a lot of home in your referencing. And I love that the maturity of a songwriter can find that kind of depth. I know when I listened to Paul Simon's album last year, Seven Psalms, about his journey to the next place, I found that hugely inspiring, listening to other people to find where my destination is. Have you considered where your destination within all of that?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that Paul Simon record and Another Place, as it were, as a destination. And that's how I finish the album, to jump to the end.
Yeah.
There's a track called I Know Where I'm Going, a title which I probably borrowed from the Paul and Pressburger movie from 1949, which is one of my favourite films, which is about a woman who's about to get married to someone on a Scottish island and never gets there. But I wanted to write, I don't think I had a thought in my head when I sat at the piano that day, but I had that title and it was going round, and I just thought it was a song about mortality. It was a song about the fact that, you know, my wife's a lot younger than me, my children are, you know, still growing, and that at some stage I won't be here, and that I envisage myself sitting on a cliff edge with the sea calming and a boat waiting and an island in the distance, and that I would get to that island and climb the spiral staircase of the lighthouse and send back signals, you know, subtle signals. And that was the song. And it was one of those songs that doesn't have a bridge. It doesn't have a chorus. It's an AAA song. And, you know, all the verses except one begin, I know where I'm going. I felt so happy to write that song. It's about finding a place of bliss as well.
Yeah.
It's about sort of a spirituality that, you know, because I'm not a religious person, so, but I'm sort of poetically religious, if you like. And,
yes.
And that's what I was trying to capture.
Yeah, well, you did it really well. And will you take any of this touring?
I don't know. I don't sort of build songs with a band in mind at the moment. You know, there are songs with sweeping strings, you know, like Take the Wheel. And
it's an expense as well, isn't it, taking a
and
band?
And work. Yeah, I mean, this is...
It's a lot of PDs.
It's a big expense, and I think I don't know the size venues I can play, to be honest, and I don't know what I can afford, and if that's going to be just blowing $100,000 on something that's just going to give me a little bit of pleasure.
Yeah.
I would like to do it, but I'm just sort of, you know, being honest about it. I will be going out and doing some more stuff with Nick, probably, so that's a commitment that I don't mind. So that quenches my thirst for live work, but I do feel really happy with these songs. We mentioned home, and I never really thought about it, to be honest. But yes, there's songs about my mum and dad when working hard, you know, showing me a certain level of work ethic. And there's songs like Borough Town, which is very much about London and a city in flux, and Windswept Street, which is about Soho.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, there are, you know, there's definitely a sense of home in it. And I've not used that word in any of the chats I've been having about it, but thank you.
And what about acting? Is it something that you still aspire to do? Because that was a big part of your life.
It's not in my control, that's the thing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I can phone my agent and say, you got any auditions I can go to? I prefer it when I get offered something.
Yeah.
And for me, the favourite part of acting is theatre. So I was lucky enough to do a few Harold Pinter plays in the West End over the last few years, and with Jamie Lloyd, who's an amazing director to work with. And that I love, because I love being in a company. Well, we're not touring, we can go home, but you're really reliant on each other, and that musicality that you have when you're playing on stage. The timing is so important.
Oh, my God.
And you really can't let anyone down. Because you imagine being on stage where, instead of all playing at once, you all had a little bit, someone else had another little bit, and then the drummer played a little bit, and then, oh, God, it's my turn again. You know, there's a lot to juggle and remember and get the timing right.
If only. That'd be modern jazz.
I know. And then you can't say at the end of it, oh, you know what, you know, I'm sorry I screwed up that bit tonight. You can't do that, because if you start to unravel it, it's just horrendous. Like, imagine if you suddenly say the line you're meant to say 5 minutes later. I love all of that. I love the tension. And I love how you can perfect it and tweak it every single time you go on stage, 8 shows a week. And also, I live in the West End pretty much. So to walk to work is...
Oh, how wonderful. I
just love doing theatre. Yeah. Love it, yeah.
I'm so envious of you. It's wonderful.
And I've enjoyed doing that stuff with my brother as well, the mockumentary stuff.
Yeah.
The Kemp's All True and All Gold. That was a great laugh. And I actually did a little appearance on the Wyndham Theatre the other week as a surprise guest in the Inside Number 9 show.
Oh, really? Fabulous.
Which is mad. You get brought on with a bag over your head.
Do you?
Yeah, it's so scary, but it's hilarious.
There was a Morecambe and Wise show once in the West End, and they used to have guests like they would have done in Morecambe and Wise. I remember Robbie Williams in one of them once, which was a big surprise.
Yeah, I think they, they're very inspired, but influenced by Morecambe and Wise. Yeah.
So your new album, you know, you've got all the trimmings that a new album needs—a record label, PR, and stuff like that. Even AI making videos for you. I mean, this is an industry that I don't really recognise anymore. It's not really something that I can tip my toe into. But does it bring security to you?
I think I have to accept that, you know, I'm not going to break the charts, that this is a record that's going to be around for a long time and people will discover it in months' time. And so I'm not chasing a number one or anything like that.
No.
It's a very different process now. They rely a lot on your social media. And the numbers on your social media really do count. So if you're an artist who's completely ignored social media, then it's more difficult for the record company to know how to sell you. As I say, they've got me on lots of TV programs, which I'm open to, you know. I've got a very commercial audience, you know. I mean, a lot of, tell myself I'm making art pop, if you like. But, you know, a lot of my audience came out of the 80s and sit watching Lorraine, you know. So hey, I need to go on Lorraine to talk, and you talk in a slightly different head with the one I used when I'm talking to you know.
Yeah.
But what is odd is what people want now is kind of warts and all, you know. They want behind the scenes all the time, and how far are you willing to go, you know. I was speaking to a friend in the music business the other day, and he said that he won't do videos of himself in the kitchen. He only does it in his studio. And, you know, his Instagram page is his own proper curation. I thought that was cool. You know, I thought that he'd said that. But everybody, you know, look at David Gilmour, a man of such sort of intellectual mystery. And then suddenly on this album, he's doing his kitchen videos and his behind the scenes and his chat. Because that's what people want. And I wonder why they want that now. Because back when I was a kid, I didn't want to know what Brian Ferry's kitchen looked like, you know. I couldn't even imagine him having one, you know. And, you know, and Bowie, you wanted them to have mystique. You wanted to aspire to their minimal lifestyle of, you know, just art. That's how they lived. They lived in art. And, you know, people don't want that now. Why don't they want that mystique? I mean, maybe they do. You look at the Grammys and you see people turning up in all those ridiculous clothes, and maybe that's what people aspire to now. But maybe it's because everyone thinks they can be a celebrity, and, you know, everyone's got their page that they've developed for themselves that makes them feel like they're out there in the public eye. And so they don't want anyone that's, you know, we've got Ed Sheeran. You couldn't get more ordinary than Ed Sheeran. Could get more down to earth, you know.
Yeah.
Did those people exist back in the 70s and 80s like that? Maybe Gilbert O'Sullivan, but he was all kind of fabricated as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, I agree. The mystery was the root of the journey for me. Like you say, I didn't want to know anything about David Bowie or Brian Ferry, Roxy Music, but behind the scenes, I just wanted to be swimming around in their songs and their art.
Yeah.
I would almost be embarrassed if I knew that they had a kitchen.
Even punk, right? The Sex Pistols, dressed by Vivian Westwood in clothes that ordinary kids could only dream of. Sorry, that's my dog.
That's all right. That's fine.
Someone's at the door. Go on, off you go. And, you know, or the Clash, you know, or in their paint splattered suits, you know, looking, you know, or you've got Generation X, Billy Idol looking properly like a pop star, you know, and so, yeah, but there's a judgment now, isn't there, as well, that, you know, you mustn't party and you mustn't, you know, so, you know, has it made it flat, I wonder?
Well, the Help Musicians charity was extraordinary during COVID lockdown. It gave out like £20 million to young writers, young producers who had fallen flat, didn't have any money, nowhere to go, no stages to play. And so I think that time when everybody had to reflect gave them their own stage. It's like, yes, they turned to Instagram. They became people outside of their living room.
Well, even Brian May, you know, on showing you all his guitar solos on at home in his living room on Instagram. So there was a leveling, wasn't there, during COVID?
There was,
That's right. That's right. I'm interested in this charity because I know the chair of the Royal Society of Musicians, which is very near me, and that is a similar body. In fact, they communicate with each other quite a bit, so I guess so they don't tread on each other's toes. But the Royal Society of Musicians was started up in the early 18th century, I believe, and it's more classical musician-based, but it helps musicians of all genres when they reach hard times.
Yes, well, Help Musicians was started by Edward Elgar.
Ah, well.
And the reason why he started it is because a violinist he was friends with passed away and his family couldn't afford to bury him. So they all gathered round and chipped in some money to bury him. And that he thought, well, we got to look after each other. So he started the charity. It's been going for, you know, 100 years or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It does cover all genres of music.
Yeah.
You know, they have an offshoot, which is called Music Minds Matters, which is for people who need a bit of well-being, a bit of therapy. You can call up and you can get that and you can get money towards your therapy because a lot of musicians suffer.
You know, I approached this album in probably the worst mind space that I've ever experienced. And I was trying to work it out why I was like that, but it sort of came out of probably being through COVID and the lockdown and living through doom scrolling and also my parents died 4 days of each other and I never really got through that. I never really dealt with that. I felt that for me that the writing was the only thing that was therapy for me. That work, trying to go into my writing room with those questions and find some answers and feeling satisfied that I'd empowered myself with the songs as I was going through writing the album. If you're not a songwriter, you don't have that ability, you know, and it is a business that is, you're so insecure in because one minute it's all happening for you, the next it isn't, and you don't have any regularity, you don't know if you're going to be able to afford the bills, etc. And generally, maybe people who are sensitive become musicians, you know, and become writers. People who are sort of move with the wind very easily, and that's why it's a beautiful place to be in art, because there's so much sensitivity. But of course, you can be knocked off balance quite quickly.
Yeah, takes a lot of therapy and well-being to be in a band.
yeah,
and to be in a music business, because it's just not the way that I thought it was when I was 18 years old. But you know, there is progress in other ways, I guess.
Do you think that there's a future in music as it used to be, you know, as we've known it? Or are people going to be more interested in other mediums as time goes on? I mean, is there...
Well, it's interesting. I think for a band like us, for instance, we've discovered a younger audience, particularly in America, and they've mainly come through either the kids thumbing through the parents' record collection or going on Spotify and finding things.
100%. There is much more... They are more archivists now than they used to be.
Used to be,
and the other day, I was coming home from the theatre and I thought, I'd call my 15-year-old, make sure he's in bed, going to bed because he's got school tomorrow. What are you doing, Kit? He said, oh, Dad, I can't go to bed right now. I'm just on the sofa listening to Can't Buy a Thrill on vinyl.
What?
Yeah. Steely Dan. I mean, I burst with pride. I was so glad to hear that. And, and then when I got back, it was just finishing. And he had the gatefold open. He was actually looking at the credits.
No.
And then he said, have you got any Marvin Gaye? Come on. Get in there, find some Marvin Gaye. You can listen to that before you go to bed. So I think there is, you know, because of YouTube and because of streaming. Streaming has really helped Heritage Acts, as they call us in the business. So it's not all bad.
It's not all bad. Gary, thank you so much for your time.
And thanks, Chris.
I wish you very well with the record. And
cheers, mate.
And getting back on the theatre stage. I'd love to come and see you.
We had Elvis on recently. Have you had him on?
No, he keeps saying he'll come on, but then he disappears. He's a bit like a trout. You can't really keep hold of him.
Yeah.
Was he fun
to
talk to?
He talks.
He talks,
yeah. No, he was great. I mean, I'm a massive admirer of him.
Yeah,
I mean,
me too.
What a lyricist he is, as you are yourself.
Extraordinary. Oh, thank you anyway, Gary. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Gary, for coming onto my podcast. I know you're a busy boy. And you were so open and honest with me about your incredible career. It's a very interesting career, Gary, going from having the fire lit by seeing the Sex Pistols to being in a band with Nick Mason of Pink Floyd. There was so much that I enjoyed, particularly you being reunited with your Fender Strat. I lost so many guitars during my youth through stupidity, so I know how it must feel to get one back under your arm. If you want to know more about the amazing work that Help Musicians does, then take a look at their website, follow them on social media like I do, and please consider donating a little money to the charity. They do incredible work supporting musicians of all types across the UK, changing people's lives for the better. And don't forget, I'm taking your questions about anything music-wise, from writing, recording, touring, and everything in between. Your well-being, maybe. Send your questions to chris@helpmusicians.org.uk. That's chris@helpmusicians.org.uk. And please subscribe to the podcast. It makes all the difference. Keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favourite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.